You're listening to Trucking Questions from the Audio Road with Kevin Rutherford. This is the show that puts the money where it belongs, back in your pocket. You can ask questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, tax, technology, or anything else about the business of trucking. Here we go. Let's head on down the Audio Road.
Welcome to the program. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. We take your calls and we answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, all kinds of stuff. All you have to do is the phone and join us. One of the things the show has always been about is education. And if you've been listening to the show for a long time, you know that over the years we've progressed. In the beginning, we talked primarily about fuel economy, and then we would add things. We added bookkeeping and accounting, and we try to move people along through different things that I think are important and just take time to teach. And we've been through many different maintenance systems on the truck. We've tried to help educate on the fuel system, on the intake system, on the engine electronics, on the electrical system, on the charger cooler. And one of the areas that I know is critically important, and we haven't spent a lot of time on it because I haven't had the resources necessarily that I wanted, is the brake system. And one of the things coming up fairly quickly here, Safety Week, I think maybe the 4th of June. So it's really not all that far away. It's something if you start thinking about now, you can get prepared for, and it doesn't have to be so stressful. You know, it's amazing to me that there are people who just take that week off because they don't want to deal with the possibility of getting a full level one inspection. It seems to me like it'd be a much better idea to get your truck in good working order so that you absolutely know you can pass a level one inspection. A lot of the people coming to the CMC will be covering a lot of this information there. But if you look at the records for Safety Week, which I do every year, never changes. As far back as I can remember, and as far back as I've been checking the records, the number one out-of-service criteria during Safety Week is a brake issue, usually brake adjustment, but it is always, by far, number one, the thing that puts people out of service. So leading up to Safety Week, we are going to start focusing on brake systems, how they work, brake adjustment, brake maintenance. I've got some great resources that I am putting together some things now. So we're not going to do anything specifically today, but just to kind of give you a heads up, that is the next area that we're going to start focusing on. And, you know, we've brought about oil analysis. Now we've been talking about that for years. Cooling systems and all of those issues that we've covered. Now it's time to cover one of the more important systems on the truck, and certainly the system that causes most of the problems in level one inspections and certainly during Safety Week coming up. So with that said, we are going to get to some phone calls. Let's get started. Let's go to Missouri. Grant, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Kevin. Thank you for what you do for us.
You're welcome. What's on your mind today?
Well, I have a quick question. I had some front-end work done in Kansas City and had Chad do an alignment for me about 2 weeks ago, and the truck's never driven better. He suggested that I drive, keep my steer tires at 120 PSI. The other day I checked them cold, and they were at 115, and then when I checked them hot, they were at 130. What I would like to know is, when should I check them, when they're hot or cold?
Yeah, this confuses a lot of people, and we'll talk about when to check them, and then we'll talk about some of the areas that confuse people. I always check cold, and So that for me is first thing in the morning before the truck ever rolls anywhere, or if that's in the evening for you, but it's at the start of the day, whatever your start is, before we roll. Now, some people will say, well, yeah, but it's 32 degrees when I get up, and it's going to be 70 degrees later in the day. Or it's, you know, I know that this morning I'm on the desert floor, but by this afternoon I'm going to be at 6,000 feet. And all of those things will change the reading. But we have to just pick a time and a place and be consistent, because none of those things are ever going to change. We're always going to be in varying temperatures, varying altitudes. All of those things will always change. What we found is that even when we go to what a lot of people consider the extreme high end of the range, you know, 120 to a lot of people sounds extreme. It's really not. It's only because of what the industry has considered normal, and that has come from years and years of fleets who try to, you know, figure out where they can always be safe. Well, we don't want to deal with 1,000 trucks being managed by one tire guy. We want to deal with you, an owner-operator who's going to manage his own tires, and we want to give you the best way, not the average way. What we found is even if we take the biggest extremes, meaning that you get up in the morning and it's 30 degrees and you're at high altitude or low altitude, and we check it then and you're at 120, and later in the day it's going to be 85 degrees, you still will not overinflate that tire. And that's an extreme. You know, it's never going to get any worse than that, and you will not overinflate the tire by doing it that way. So I always check at the beginning of the day before the truck is running, and I don't really try to adjust for ambient temperature.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate what you do, and you have a great day.
And one more thing, let me add to that, and that is because we do tend to run higher pressures than what is considered normal. What I've learned over the years is there's really only two downsides to higher tire pressure. One of them is just comfort. The tire will be stiffer. Your ride is going to be worse. It's not horrible unless you have a truck that really rides horrible already. On most trucks today, they ride good enough that you're going to notice a difference if you've never run your tires up that high, but I don't see it as any big deal. I just like to warn people about that. The other thing we want to watch for is any irregular wear that we might cause if we're too high. But that's it. If there's no irregular wear, we're not too high. And if there is some irregular wear and we can identify it as being because of inflation, then we back it down 5 pounds on your truck. One truck might run at 120, another truck might do better at 115. But I found on steer tires, and I think you heard this from Chad as well, that typical, oh, we always run them at 100. Yeah, it's a little harder on fuel economy, it's harder on tire wear, and that's why we've kind of bumped up all of those numbers over the years. Let's go to Florida. Paul, welcome to the program.
How about you, boss man? Fairtex now.
What's up today?
Oh, I wanted to ask you a couple of questions about that Frankenstein of an oil sample report you should have in front of you.
Let's take a look. I do have one here.
I've copied and pasted a whole bunch of them together. That way we've got a long history on the truck.
Got it. So give me some background on what's going on with this while I'm kind of scanning some of the history here.
Right now she's doing all right, no problems, 1.4 million on the truck. The last oil sample was taken after the truck sat for 5 months. Other than that, up until sample number 11, she was running straight, year round. I'm looking at the iron and the copper, and I'm wondering, now I did some work on the oil cooler, so back at number 9 or 10, so I could understand. I mean, I didn't replace it. I just replaced the seals, but I could understand the copper numbers coming up, but now they're starting to go back down, and in correlation, the iron numbers are going up. So I'm wondering, I know there's multi-metals in bearings, so what do I need to be looking for when I start seeing bearing wear?
Well, where's your lead? I haven't been able to get the sample open yet.
Lead is, let's see, that's a wear metal, right? Yeah, it's zero. Yeah. I mean, it's been one, two. It was five at one time, so, a long time ago, but it's zero now.
Got it. And that's really good. Here's the progression. The outer coating of the bearing is lead. The inner coating is copper. We have to get through a lot of lead, a pretty significant amount of lead, before we get to the copper. And when we see copper alone, it really can't be a bearing. It is normally coming from the oil cooler, and it can be very erratic. And I'm going to get to a break, and then I'll come back, and we'll talk more about that. But that is a good sign, and maybe by then I'll have this oil sample open as well. So stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Before the break, I was talking with Paul about oil samples, and we're going to get right back to that. And I do have that oil sample in front of me now.
It's a strange looking one, ain't it?
Yeah, it's a little weird. And like you said, it gives me lots of history, so that's good. Here's the thing about the oil cooler and copper. There's nothing consistent about it. It is just all over the board. I have seen new oil coolers that will leach a lot of copper in the beginning and then stop. I've seen new oil coolers that don't leach any copper. I've seen an oil cooler that doesn't leach copper for 8 years and a million miles and then all of a sudden spikes and then goes away.
Gotcha.
I mean, I haven't found any consistent pattern. You're seeing a little bit of that. You saw copper climbing really slowly but pretty steadily and then jumped up all of a sudden, and now it's on its way back down. Almost guaranteed to be oil cooler. In fact, I've never really seen a pattern like that be anything but the oil cooler. And because we don't have any lead, we're not concerned about the bearings. I mean, you haven't touched the bearings. Like you said, this last one, you're at zero.
Yes. So when I'm looking for bearings, I'm looking for lead, then copper, then iron.
Never iron, not on the bearings themselves. Iron. If we get to copper, if we get to any significant, if we have a lot of lead, and then we start to get to significant copper, the bearing probably is going to have to be replaced. And so that's the progression. Iron, what we're looking at primarily is upper cylinder, liners, pistons, those kind of things. But the other thing about iron is that it will always climb when we do extended drains. It's so fine that there isn't a filter on the planet that's ever going to get it out of there. But we're talking about really, really tiny amounts. So on yours, for example, we're talking about 82 parts per million to nothing. Now, what I like to look at is, how many miles are on the oil that was taken when this sample was taken?
Oh, about 100,000.
Okay. So, you know, after looking at these things for years and years, the lab has flagged this at a level 2, which virtually means nothing. I mean, you're just going to monitor it. What I found, though, is when we're doing extended drains, that I usually say about 10 parts per million for every 10,000 miles. So if you've got 100,000 miles on the oil, then if I see the iron at 100, that's pretty darn close to average from what I always see.
Okay.
If it was 120, I wouldn't be worried at all, and you're actually at 80. So you're lower than what I would expect to see.
All right, thank you. Two other ones I want you to look at. Potassium, it jumped, and boron. Why has it been going down?
Boron is the last two sections over there on the right, either multi-source or additive. Additive is clearly only stuff that could potentially be added to the oil as an additive package. And when I say potentially, it really depends on the oil and the package that they use. Some oils use moly, some don't. Some use phosphorus, some don't. Some use it at very different amounts. The one thing I can tell you that the additive metals, in all the years I've looked at tens of thousands of samples, that has never once been an issue that we ever needed to address. Like if they just dropped that off the chart, it wouldn't bother me a bit. Multi-source means that it could be an additive metal, or it could be a contaminant metal, or it could possibly be a wear metal. But again, these things are so out there. Like, I don't think we have any engines with titanium in them. You know, if somebody built titanium connecting rods, then we might worry, or titanium rings, but they don't really exist. So we don't worry about them. If it's under multi-source, it's really going to be an additive. Boron is an additive. Yeah, and it could go down for several reasons. You could stick with the exact same oil, but if you got a couple gallons on the East Coast and you've got a couple gallons on the West Coast, the same brand, same make, everything identical on the bottle, they could have wildly different boron readings right out of the bottle. And if you switch oils or just use a gallon of makeup oil that's different, now your additive package could be all over the board. But the good news is I've never seen it hurt anything.
Gotcha. Now the potassium number jumped, but it's still small. Is that a problem?
Nope. If they don't flag it, I don't even look at it.
All right. Well, that was all I had for you today. I appreciate your time, boss.
All right. Good stuff. Thanks for the call. Let's head off to Illinois. Dave, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. Thanks for taking the call.
What's on your mind?
I had a couple quick, I know you don't think they're easy, but tax questions.
Okay.
First one was, I remember a few years ago, there was some talk about the IRS wanting to change something to, corporation-to-corporation transactions needing to be 1099.
Right.
You remember that? Is that getting any groundwork, or is that pretty much not going to happen?
Yeah, let me tell you what happened with that. That was actually part of Obamacare, believe it or not. You wonder, what the hell would 1099s between corporations have to do with Obamacare? Here's what it was all about. It's just a typical government, let's stuff everything we can into a bill because nobody will be able to read it, nobody will notice. Only goal was to get increased reporting so that they could possibly go after more people that might not have been paying enough tax. That was the whole point behind that. The problem was somebody did catch it, even though it was buried in, tens of thousands of pages of Obamacare. It got caught pretty quick by the business groups that said, you have got to be kidding me. This is insanity. The amount of paperwork that would have been generated in time, so quickly that one blew up on them, and enough groups came out quick enough that they just dropped that out of Obamacare completely.
So that's not still on the agenda then?
Nope, it is gone.
Okay. And then the other thing I was curious about is when you're doing your expenses, okay, is everything, as far as what we're writing off, is it a dollar-for-dollar thing? So, like, if my fuel is, say, $50,000, is my accountant writing off $50,000?
Well, yeah, let me explain. And again, because it's taxes, there's never a simple answer. let's just start with some easy numbers. Let's say, just for the sake of discussion, you grossed $100,000 in revenue, meaning that's how much money people paid you to move freight or do whatever it is you do. We have $100,000 to start with. Now we have expenses. We can also call those expenses deductions. We get to deduct them from the gross revenue before we pay tax. The deduction itself is dollar for dollar. Absolutely. There are a couple tiny little exceptions, and I don't even want to go into them right now because they'll just confuse this discussion. For the most part, everything we talk about, fuel, maintenance, tolls, scales, tires, all those things, supplies, they are all dollar for dollar deductions. What confuses people, though, is that dollar for dollar deduction doesn't mean a dollar for dollar tax reduction. So that's where people get confused. And many times people will say, well, I buy chrome, but it's tax deductible. Yes, it is. Or my accountant told me to go buy a new truck because I needed the tax deduction. That to me is faulty thinking, because when we get down to the bottom line, the amount of tax we pay, a business deduction is only about 30 cents on the dollar. So when we get down to the how much tax you're going to pay, every dollar you spend in deductions will reduce your taxable bill by about 30 cents. Does that all make sense?
Yeah, that kind of leads me to a second part of that question. So like on profit gauges, does that automatically do that, or is that something the accountant has to do?
What profit gauges does is take your, and it creates a report that shows the tax preparer how much you grossed and how much you spent in each one of the categories that you use. And it is a true dollar for dollar, because in accounting, it's dollar for dollar. You grossed $100,000. We spent $30,000 in fuel. We spent $8,000 in maintenance. We spent $800 on scales. So the accountant looks at the tax report, and he can see all those numbers. Now, he takes those numbers, and he plugs them into the tax return, and that's where we start seeing how much tax you're going to owe. So yeah, Profit Gauges does everything the tax preparer needs to see.
Okay. And then real quick, as far as the grain-free diet you were talking about yesterday?
Yeah.
Is that basically like a gluten-free, like I'm hearing all about?
Nope, and I'm glad you asked that, because that is what is screwing a lot of people up. And when we come back, I'm going to get to a break. And when we come back, we will talk about that, because that is a critically important piece of this that I think is messing a lot of people up. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rothberg. All right, everybody, hold on just a second. We're experiencing some internet issues here, and I'm trying to get everything reloaded. It looks as though our the system that we use, Blog Talk, to do all the calls is having some technical issues. I can get through on the audio side. I can't get through on the internet side in order to be able to looks like we might have a backup. So let me just make sure we've got it, and then we'll get right back to this. All right, so here we go. Let me double check. Okay. Looks like we got it. Here we go on this segment. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The number to join us, 8888 Road Dog. I'm going to go back to Illinois. Dave, you with me?
Yes.
Okay. So, you know, I think I've said many, many times now over the last, I might even be going on about 6 months now. I have been taking the way I normally approach trucks and fuel mileage and tires and oil samples, and I've been taking a lot of my time and energy and doing just, I could be coming close to 1,000 hours now of research on health and nutrition and all of the latest stuff I can find. And I look back over, you know, what we've been through in the past. And one of the things that became really clear to me is that many of the so-called diets that make it to the mainstream, they're based on a good idea, but by the time they make it to the mainstream, and instead of people really researching what the diet was all about, they get little bits and pieces and sound bites from the media. That is where we go off the rails the first time. And then the big food companies jump on the bandwagon, use the code words, and then we just completely get off track from what this was supposed to be. So you are on the right track. Gluten is a protein that's in wheat. And if we were to look at all the grains, so we have things like wheat, rye, barley, spelt, corn is actually a grain, rice is a grain. Human beings were never meant to eat those things. And for the first 2.5 million years we were on the planet, we didn't eat them. It's only been about 10,000 years. And if you look at the history, it's been in those 10,000 years that we've wiped out our health. Things like diabetes, insulin resistance, high blood pressure, cavities, so many things, obesity. I could go on and on and on. All of those things came about after we started eating grains. Now, in the last 30 years, the consumption of grains have just exploded, mostly because the FDA and the USDA and all these government agencies came out and said, you need to eat a low-fat diet. All the fat is causing heart disease. Well, the problem is the studies were all flawed. Fat was not causing heart disease. Fat wasn't causing obesity. And when you take fat out of the diet, you have to replace it with something. And we ended up replacing it with grains, with pastas, breads, rice, you know, all corn products. And then the more we process food, the more they put these products in and we don't even know they're in there because of all the weird names. So, but if we look at all of those grains, the worst offender is gluten. Gluten is a protein that is virtually toxic to your body. Now, some people, it is so toxic that it will almost kill them. Those people are, they have a disease called celiac disease. Only about 1% of the population, though. But everybody has it is toxic in some form or another to virtually everybody. So what happened is, if you were going to just eliminate one thing, you would try to focus on anything that contained gluten. And gluten is primarily in wheat. Now, it's in some other things. If you're in a plant that processes wheat, then gluten ends up in all kinds of other stuff. Gluten gets added to processed foods for a lot of reasons. So when the media jumped on the whole gluten-free, then the food companies jumped on board, and this is typically what happens. So you had companies that, one, were putting gluten-free on foods that never had gluten in the first place. So why would you bother to put gluten-free on the label? Well, they do it because people were just glomming onto this idea of gluten-free. The other problem, which is much worse, is pasta had a lot of gluten. So if we want to make a gluten-free pasta, they have to look for alternatives to wheat. So they would start looking at things like tapioca starch, potato starch, all these other ingredients that, sure, they don't have gluten, but the glycemic index, the way that that food affects your blood sugar, which is another huge problem, is way worse than the wheat was. So people think they're eating healthy because they're eating gluten-free products, and they just replaced one problem with a different problem. So 99% of the products that used to have gluten and now don't, they just have six other grains in them. They don't have wheat anymore. So, yeah, you got rid of the gluten problem, but you created a blood sugar problem because of the glycemic index of those foods. I it's kind of like taxes. I am really working hard to try to make it simple, and I can make it simple unless I have to explain all the reasons why. If I could just say, do this, 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 and this, it would be really simple. But if I have to explain the reasons why, that's where the thousands of hours of research came in. Did that help at all?
Yeah, no, it totally helps. I grasp that better than the tax issue.
Good.
So, yeah.
Good. So there, yeah. When we talk about the biggest problems in our diet, the grains themselves are toxic. That's one problem, and all different levels of toxicity. Like oats aren't as bad as wheat. Rice isn't as bad as oats. But they're all bad, just some are less bad than others. That's one issue. And then if you take that issue of toxicity and set it aside, the next issue behind grains is that they are really crazy high in carbohydrates, and whole grains are actually worse. Even though we've been told healthy whole grains, there's no such thing. That's an oxymoron. Believe it or not, one slice of whole wheat bread raises your blood sugar higher than a teaspoon of pure sugar, higher than a banana, which is, a banana is really high in sugar, but one slice of whole wheat bread raises your blood sugar more than a teaspoon of pure sugar or a whole banana.
Wow. That's crazy.
So that's, yeah, so, you know, it's something that I get a little crazy about. Sometimes I get a little over-passionate about. I've learned so much, I want to share it. And I'm working on not getting overboard, not going crazy, but it is something that I want to continue helping people with, and I'm going to keep putting some programs together. Kim's also doing a great job of getting that information out as well. Let's go to Kentucky. Ken, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Kevin. Thanks for kicking me in the head, at least getting me on fuel gauges.
Good, good. What can I help you with today?
Just got on a dedicated flatbed run where I've got a really light load, and it's going to be consistent for probably 9 months. So my question is, if I take off, you know, if I only run 150 gallons of fuel rather than 300, you know, and I take off my chains, binders, and headache rack and tarps, maybe another 1,000 pounds, so maybe a ton of weight would come off, what would that equate to in a fuel mileage gain?
Okay, so when you say a ton, do you mean a literal ton, like 2,000 pounds?
Yes.
Okay, I wanted to make sure you weren't using a ton the way I do, like it's a ton of fun. Or okay, so there is a formula, and the formula is roughly, and the reason I say roughly is because when we talk about weight and how it affects fuel economy, we have to take almost every other variable into account, and it starts to get really confusing. And that isn't always the case. When we talk about rolling resistance, it's pretty straightforward. But when we talk about weight and how it affects fuel economy, speed is a huge factor. Weight will affect fuel economy much, much more at 70 miles an hour than it does at 55 miles an hour. The terrain has a huge impact. Weight will affect fuel economy much more aggressively if we have to do a lot of climbing as opposed to being on level ground. So I can throw a number out there that's an average, and it gives us an idea, but it could vary quite a bit based on all these other factors. But the rough number to go by is every 1,000 pounds you reduce payload or overall weight, I shouldn't say payload, anywhere we could reduce overall weight, every 1,000 pounds improves fuel economy by about 0.8%. So it's less than 1% for 1,000 pounds. So if we could reduce 10,000 pounds, you know, we'd be at 8%, which is fairly significant. But you've got to get up to some pretty big numbers. At 2,000, we'd still be less than a 2% gain in fuel economy, which we actually can't measure. I mean, that's too small to measure in a one truck test. But having said all that, well, let me get to a break, and then I'll come back and we'll talk about what I think you should be doing. Stick around. I'm Kevin Rutherford. All right, just a real quick heads up. We're heading into segment 4. That means at the end of this, I'll say I'm done. Good night. I've got to get out of here. Don't hang up because we'll come back and do another hour. Here we go. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're down to the final segment. I'm going to get right back to the calls. So, Ken, here's the way I look at weight reduction. Because you've got to reduce a lot of weight to get a relatively small improvement in fuel economy, and it's very difficult to measure, what I normally recommend is reduce weight every chance you can if you're not spending any real money to do it or if you're not really inconveniencing yourself. Like, you know, I wouldn't tell somebody, oh, don't carry all those tools around because, you know, it's just excess weight. Well, the tools, having the tools available is way more important than the tiny, tiny little bit of fuel savings we're going to get. But for you, if you absolutely know that on this run, you don't need binders, chains, tarps, all of those things, and you don't need this other fuel tank, yeah, take it off. It's not really costing you anything to get rid of it. It's not going to, you know, put you in a bind because you don't have it somewhere later down the road, and it will save some fuel.
Okay, in relation to that, so if I don't spend any money to take off weight, it will benefit me flat out. So
yeah, but you know, when
lift axle,
when we look at, go ahead.
I've got a lift axle, flatbed spread axle. I'm running with only one axle down and one axle up on the trailer. Can I take off those rips of tires and still run around legally?
Yes. Yeah, you only have to have the available tires on the ground that you need to carry the weight. We can take the whole axle out. If that's something that you know you're going to be on this run for a while, you take the whole axle out and make trailer a single axle if you want. And that might not be a bad idea. You know, it's no different than because I pulled doubles, I only ran single axle tractors. Why carry around an axle, a set of tires, brakes, all that other stuff if we don't need it? I was just talking about, you know, safety week and level one inspections. Why have another axle up there that we could potentially have problems on if we don't need the axle in the first place?
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Yeah, but when we look at things like, say, aluminum fifth wheels or aluminum brake drums, very expensive compared to conventional. In my opinion, there's no payback there. The companies that use those are companies that their payload is how they make their money. If they can put another 1,000 pounds of payload, the revenue goes up significantly. In that case, it normally makes sense to spend money to lighten up the equipment. But if we're talking about fuel mileage, the numbers just don't work. Cut weight where you can if it doesn't cost much or inconvenience you, or you know, if you're not going to be missing things you should have with you at certain times. But don't spend much money to cut weight. There's just not a payback there. Let's go to Illinois. Tom, welcome to the program.
Well, good afternoon.
Got a question
for you here. Brake clutch or clutch brake, whatever you want to call it.
Okay.
What causes it to go bad? I mean, right now I've got a truck. I've got about 80,000 miles on it. And it has gotten to the point where it's getting very difficult when I come to a stop to put it back into first gear, second gear, whatever.
Yep.
And because that clutch brake doesn't seem to be, it doesn't stop the thing from spinning. So anyway, how did I screw this up?
You did. This isn't a perfect analogy, but I think it will help you understand what's happening. You understand how a brake works, right? You have a brake pad with material on it, and every time you use that brake, you wear a little bit of material off.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, you don't have any material anymore, and you have to replace it or it won't stop the wheel anymore. That's the same thing that's happening here. This is an expendable item. It wears out a tiny little bit every time you use it. So eventually, we just don't have the braking power anymore. How many miles are on this clutch?
About 80,000.
80,000?
Yeah, that's all. It's a 2014 glider, Freightliner glider.
Okay. So
one of those I got at Harrison, but the fuel mileage is good on this one.
Oh, good. Good. And this isn't a glider issue or a part issue or anything like that. I'm going to guess that this is nothing more than an adjustment issue. So I would get it back in and let them take a look at the throw, the adjustment, those kind of things. I think it would be virtually impossible to wear out a clutch brake at 80,000 miles. I've seen clutch brakes last 1,000,000 miles.
Yeah, because I've never had a problem. I mean, I've had clutch brake problems before, but it's always been for, 300,000, 400,000 miles. And
yeah,
I didn't know whether or not I did something here. Because, I mean, I don't use a clutch when I'm going down the road. And so I didn't know if that, maybe I need to start using the clutch. I don't know. I'm kind of baffled by this one.
Yeah, well, let me put your mind at ease. The use of the clutch or not when you're shifting has nothing to do with the clutch brake itself.
Okay.
So there are some different clutch assemblies out there. Different styles of clutches. We have the solo, we have self-adjusting clutches. Volvo has their hydraulic clutch. They're all slightly different. Most clutch brakes are adjustable. Not all clutches are adjustable. The throw on the travel on the pedal and some other things can be adjusted. But normally we're talking about two different things, the function of the clutch and the function of the clutch brake. And I have a feeling this may just be an adjustment issue.
Okay, can something like this be done, for instance, get a Petro or TA, or is this something I need to take to a Freightliner dealer, or is this something I can do myself?
Sometimes, depending on the style of the clutch, it takes two people. So,
okay.
And it's not something that's all that complicated. Now, I was just reading a note from Matt, and he's pointing out something that I'm trying to think about it while I'm talking that makes sense, but I didn't realize this. He says, coasting up to the stop sign with the clutch pushed in and in gear is like using the clutch brake to stop the truck. I get that. Now that he said that, because
makes sense.
The clutch brake is stopping that shaft so that the gears can engage because they won't be turning. So that's a very good point. If somebody got into the habit of coasting to a stop with the clutch pushed all the way in to activate the clutch brake and still in gear, you could wear your clutch brake out pretty quick. I never thought about that, so thank you, Pat, for that. But I learned something today.
Yeah, I'm not aware that I'm doing that, but I'm going to kind of start being a little bit more cognizant of that, see if I am doing it.
Yeah, like I say, I learned something today. So I would have somebody take a look at it and go from there.
Okay, I appreciate it.
All right, thanks for the call. Let's go to Oregon. James, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks for taking my call.
You know what, James?
Yep.
Hold on. I'm going to put you back on hold. We're going to go ahead and start a second hour. I'm not sure what happened there. We got all that recorded, but I need to start the next hour. So here we go. And James, I'll be coming right to you to open up the show.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs,
back in your pocket.
Welcome to the program. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. We take your calls. We answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers, you name it. We'll cover it here on the air. Our primary goal is to help educate people in the trucking industry about all the things that are important to them. And there are lots. And we will continue to bring you the very best information we can find. And we'll continue trying to help you by answering the questions you have. I'm just going to jump right to the phone calls tonight and see how many we can knock out. Let's get started in Oregon. James, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. Thanks for taking my call. I'm all set up for the CMC, and I'm pretty excited about that. Looking forward to it. I'm bringing my truck for the sole purpose of just throwing a kitchen sink at it with all the improvements and additions that we can put on that thing. And I just wanted to run that by you first to make sure I'm not out of my mind or getting way out ahead of myself, that you could maybe have something that I hadn't thought of prior to doing all that.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because over the years we've kind of gone back and forth. You know, there was a time way back when on a show where I used to say, what I want people to do is do one thing at a time and measure the difference and then move on to the next thing.
Right.
There were a couple reasons we said that. One, we want to make sure that what you did worked. So that, you know, we didn't throw four things at once, get an increase, but not really know what the increase was based on each thing. And there's still some legitimacy behind that idea. Also back then, you have to remember that there were way, way more skeptics than there are now. There's still thousands and tens of thousands of skeptics out there that don't believe anything I say, and that's fine. But there are also tens of thousands of people who are believers now. So back then, I was really, really trying to make sure people saw that when they did this, they saw this result. And we've done that for years and years, and I think people tend to trust those kind of things more often now. So now we can look at it and say, we're positive these things work. My God, we've done them tens of thousands of times over the years. We have way more proof than we ever need. We know it works. So if we know it works and we have the money to do it, why wait 30 or 60 days between each one? Because we're losing all of that opportunity. We're losing all of that money we could be saving. So now I sometimes lean towards, look, if you've got the budget and we're doing something that we know it works, just do it all. I mean, it's kind of the concept behind the signature truck. We do it all. We get a truck that gets, you know, 9+ miles to the gallon. We can't necessarily look at each and every item and tell you what it did, but we could certainly look at it all and go, this is a truck that gets great fuel economy, and look at all the money we've saved. Instead of starting at 7 miles to the gallon and working up to 9, we get 9 right out of the gate.
Right. Well, there's multiple reasons why I made the decision to do this. And, you know, one, I have the money to do it. I talked to you a couple of times about this truck, and I bought the truck in September, 1st of September, and I continue working my freight job, and I've just been working on it, you know, getting it ready to go trucking. And so now it's time to start. Now it's time to, you know, work. The way I'm looking at it, to bring it to the CMC, those folks at T&E, they've installed these items. They know exactly what they're doing, and I have a lot of confidence knowing that when I leave there, it's done right.
Well, I can tell you that there is no better place to do these improvements than at the CMC. The prices are the best you'll see all year. The installation prices, you know, I had to call Chris over at T&E when I saw the list and say, Chris, are you sure you want to do these installs for this price? I mean, they are. But they, Chris said, you know what? We've done them a lot. We've got a system. We're going to make money. He said, don't worry, I'm not going to lose money on this. He said, we know once in a while we're going to hit a truck where, you know, $325 to install an OPS isn't going to cover it. But we know averages will be good. They've been such a great partner for us. We bring them a ton of business. I mean, they bring RVs into the parking lot so their guys can get some sleep. We keep them that busy. And the prices are amazing.
Yeah, well, that's part of the decision-making going into this, because, like I said, I don't have the truck at work, so I'm like, well, it's going to cost me X amount of dollars to fly there, and it's going to cost me X amount more to drive the truck there, but the money I'm saving in the purchase price and the installation will offset the majority of the cost, the added cost to get it there.
Yep.
And so I just like, well, I'll just... You know, we'll go for that and just take it in there and just get it done, you know, and we're done with it. And I'm like a kid on Christmas morning here. I can't wait to get this stuff on that truck and drive it and just, you know, because I've been getting beat up in these old freight trucks for so many years that I just, the fantasy of having a truck like that just makes me, crazy happy.
You know, and I've done that a couple times myself. You know, I've been through several trucks over the last couple of years to pull our trailers around, a couple gliders, a couple older trucks, and I do the same thing. I mean, I could put this stuff on any time or go somewhere else, or we have all kinds of partners. Normally, I wait till the week before the CMC. I usually do mine so I'm not interfering with everybody else. But I run mine over there. They do it all at once, and you're right. It's like waking up Christmas morning.
Yeah, well, the one question, I saw the list of the things they want to do, and I'm interested in also, a Pittsburgh Power Turbo and the Power Box. Now, are they going to be willing to do the Power Box? And they're going to have the Turbo off anyway, so I don't know that that's a problem, but... I didn't see that on there in the email.
You know, I would always call to verify, but I can't think of any reason why not. For example, last year, the truck that I bought just a couple weeks before the CMC, when we got it to Kansas City, T&E pulled the ECM off, sent it to Pittsburgh Power. They reprogrammed it, sent it back, and then T&E put it back on. I can't see any reason why they wouldn't do those things.
Right, because that was another option, other than the Power Box, is to have the ECM tuned, and so I'm not sure exactly where, you know, what would be beneficial to do either or. You know, I've done everything with this truck I just put it on a dyno a couple weeks ago to make sure I had, you know, all my T's crossed and I's dotted before I started putting money into it to make sure I had a good piece to work with. And so then after that, I've got it in a shop that, you know, highly recommended to me. And they're actually, it's in a shop now getting, you know, overhead done and micro blue bearings put on and, you know, kingpins and just, you name it, it's getting done. And but they're not crazy about all this other stuff. So I thought, okay, you know, we'll just deal with the basics here, and then I'll deal with the other stuff somewhere down the road. And this is like a perfect opportunity to, you know, get with people of like thinking and say, let's just do this. And, you know, so I just wanted to make sure I wasn't really out of line thinking I could get this.
You're doing exactly what I would do, what I would recommend. And, you know, the idea of, you know, a power box or a programmed ECM really depends on a lot of different factors. Most of the time, I prefer the power box. It gives us much more control. We don't have to worry about somebody wiping out our custom programming accidentally, and that's just ugly. The reason I did the custom programming on my ECM, two reasons. One, I'm not out on the road all the time where I'm going to have to worry about going to some unknown shop. I mean, usually, worst case scenario, I would pull the ECM off and send it to Pittsburgh Power overnight if I had to. The other thing is, though, I want to experience all the things I recommend. I mean, I've experienced the power box. I can tell you exactly how it works on different engines, what it's like to drive. I hadn't custom programmed an ECM yet on a 12.7, but I need to see what this is like. I love it. I mean, it's really nice, but it is what it is. It's not like I can change it going down the road.
Well, I like the idea of the flexibility with it, you know, and then I feel like I've got the discipline not to get carried away with it. So, you know, just run it down at a reasonable rate, and, you know, because out west, you know, it's all I'm doing is mountain climbing out here, and it's all I'm going to be doing pretty much. So, it seems like a reasonable investment in for that, but it's like you're talking about all the additions. The way I look at it, it's almost as if I can't afford not to put them on. You know,
that really is a good way to look at it. You're right.
You know, yeah. So excellent. Well, I'm jazzed up about it like crazy, and everybody I'm around, I'm making them crazy because I'm just constantly talking about it. So I'm looking very much forward to meeting you and coming to the CMC and having some fun.
I appreciate it. Thanks for the call. Great stuff. We'll be right back. Stick around. I'm Kevin Rothbard. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Since we were talking about the CMC, I'll give you the latest update. Lisa just got back. We've been in Kansas City for a little bit now. We'd like to get here very early and get set up and make sure we're ready. There's a lot of stuff to do. We're very excited this year, as always. Lisa just got back from the first big meeting over at Harrah's, where they go through the schedule and all the rooms and all the logistics and food and so many things that go into an event like this. And I have to tell you that it gets better every year. This is a complicated event. I'm not sure how many people are aware, but the Harrah's Casino and Resort in Kansas City, this event is their biggest event of the year as far as one single event. We are their biggest event of the year. We have been for the last, I think this is our third year. I think 2 years ago, we became their biggest event of the year, and we keep growing. So there's a lot that goes into it, a lot of people, a lot of work behind the scenes. And, you know, we have a team led by Lisa that does just an amazing job. And Harrah's puts together a team for this event for us. And every year it gets a little better. That's part of that whole relationship building that I talk about. Now, one of the things that I've been struggling with is that we have so much more demand, so many more people want to come to the CMC, and every year our waiting list just gets bigger and bigger. This year we have more people who want to come and can't than we have coming. But we're out of space there. And, you know, we couldn't leave for two reasons. One, we signed a five-year contract. But two, we're hesitant to leave because we have built this relationship and it's making it such a great event. Now, I can't give you all the details, but I will tell you that by the end of this CMC, for the people who are there, we should, I'm hoping, have a very exciting announcement about next year. A solution that I didn't even think was possible. But this is what happens when you work on synergy and with a win-win basis, where you don't look at everything as black and white, win-lose. If we get more, you get less. You look at a true win-win, and new possibilities start to open themselves up, things you couldn't even imagine before. And we might be on the verge of a solution to the CMC that would be a huge win-win for everybody. Lots more space, still with the great relationship we have now. And other than that, I can't say much more because this is still fairly new. Now, my goal is to try to nail down next year's event before this year's event is over with. That way, when we end the event this year, like we always do, we can open it up to the people who are there. We always support the people who have supported us over the years. And a lot of people have said, you know, that's wrong, that Kevin, you've got to let new people come. I get that. I want new people to come. But I am fiercely loyal to the people who have supported me all these years. I remember being in a room with 11 people for a CMC. And I traveled, you know, thousands of miles to get there to do that CMC for 11 people. And everybody in the industry told me I was insane. It was a stupid idea. It was never going to work. I should just give up. And I didn't, because there were at least 11 people who believed in what I was doing. And some of those people still come back to the CMC this day. And we just made that decision that we will always support them because they supported us and believed in us. Now what I'm hoping is that we have a solution that will allow us to support those people just like we always have, and also allow us to bring new people in that we want there as well. So we will keep you up to date on what happens with that. Let's go to Tennessee. Aaron, welcome to the program. Aaron, are you with me? Going once. You know what, Aaron? I'm going to put you back on hold, and we'll see if I can come back to that line because I'm not sure what might be happening there. Let's try Jack in Alabama. Jack, welcome to the program. Oh, maybe it's not their phones. Maybe it's our system. So let me see what I can do with that, and let me expand on a couple other things that we've been talking about. You know, I talked a lot just a little bit ago about improvements, fuel mileage improvements, and when to do them. And over the years, I have changed in the method that I use. Not entirely. You could still do either one. This is one of those cases where it isn't necessarily one way is absolutely right and one way is absolutely wrong. It's one might be slightly better than the other. One might be better for one person than another. And in the beginning, I was a real stickler for saying, do one thing at a time, measure your results, and then make sure what you did worked. And like I explained earlier, a lot of that is because I wanted people to see that this stuff worked. I wanted them to know absolutely each individual item worked. And that was because we had so many people who doubted what we were saying and doing. And we've proven that enough times now to know that if you have the money and you want the biggest bang for your buck, you can do multiple things at once, and we can see the results, and that way you run a much better chance of improving the bottom line much more right from the start. Let me try the phones again. Let's go to Illinois. Johnny, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have a simple, well, I want to let you know I'm new to the trucking business, the industry, as an owner-operator. I kind of did the leap of faith talking to a loyal fan of yours here in Illinois who kind of challenged me before I made my decision, and I'm happy with it so far. I've been listening to your program, it's about a good maybe 3 months.
Okay.
Very interesting. I like what you say. It confuses the heck out of me, but I'm learning,
okay.
And I like that. My question is, I had this idea. Okay, I'm coming from a W-2 worker, so now I'm a 1099 worker.
Okay.
I worked for a company that reimbursed your tolls, but they don't reimburse all of them. So I thought, well, I don't know what my picture is going to look like in a whole year doing owner-operator business. Oh, and also, I started doing the profit gauges. I signed up.
Sure.
And it's challenging. Not challenging because of the program. It's challenging, like you say, to do the hard work.
Right. Exactly.
But I'm getting over it. So anyway, back to my question. What I thought was, since the company only reimburses a portion, and I'm just going to throw a number out there, let's say they give me 60% of 100% of the toll, I was thinking that instead of reporting that and having them give me the money back, and then it becomes a wash at the end of the tax season, which I'm only talking about this tax year, I'm preparing for this tax year, that it would be better for me to just do it all at the end of the year, since it's a deduction, and then that would lower what I made on the growth.
Got it. I understand. Go ahead. Yeah, I like the way you're thinking, because you're thinking. That's a good thing. But many people just don't think enough. So this tells me you're thinking. Let me give you the reason I don't want you to do what you just said, though. Let's say, I'm just going to throw out a number again because it's easy to work with. Let's say that for the whole year you would have $1,000 in tolls, just to throw a number out there.
Okay.
And let's say that the company does reimburse 60%. So your choice would either be this. Let me walk you through some numbers. You could say, they're not reimbursing the whole thing. I'm just going to deduct it myself from my taxes. So you deduct $1,000 worth of tolls, which in turn saves you $300 in your total tax bill. That's like the caller I had not long ago on another show where we said the deduction is dollar for dollar. The tax savings is 30 cents on the dollar. Or, here's the better way to do this. You have $1,000 in tolls. You turn $1,000 into the company so that they reimburse you $600. Now, we can already see we've doubled our savings, haven't we?
Yes, we have.
Plus, you still get to deduct the $400 they didn't reimburse you. You just have to keep the right records. So we can say we turned in $1,000 that we spent. We only got $600 of it back. So we still get to deduct the other $400. It was an expense to us, which means that now you save $400, which means now you save another $60. So instead of saving $300, we save $660 this way. So I hear the music playing. I'll let you think about that for a couple minutes. And I'll come back and we'll see if that makes sense. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Thank you. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. I'm going to go back to Illinois. Johnny, you still with me?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Did that make sense?
Yes, yeah, that made sense. It's the method you explained. Yeah, it definitely has a better advantage. I'm not a fanatic number person like my friend who is my mentor in this venture I've taken, who has also, you know, encouraged me to listen to you, which I have, and I've spent some money on my truck, not the $1,000 a lot of other truck drivers have done, but I'm getting started. I have spoke to the gentleman at Pittsburgh Power. I actually didn't realize I was actually talking to the owner. A couple of times that I called, kind of blew me away. Yeah. A lot of things he told me. They're really good. I mean, I do have the muffler. I paid for that. And the other thing, the air filter. I thought at first it was very, very expensive, but I bought it from the shop out in Indianapolis, from Fleet. And I am seeing the savings. Now, the hard work I am working on doing. And again, my buddy says, you know, hurry up, get it done. Keep procrastinating. And I'm going to agree. I do procrastinate, probably the unknown and the fear and the age. You know, I'm getting older and you know, family situation, you know, being only one person now.
You know, here's the thing, though. I don't see you as really procrastinating at all. I see you as thinking through things and then doing them. I know lots of people have been listening to the show, honestly, for 6 or 7 years and haven't done as much as you do. They listen. They obviously must like the show because they keep listening. But I'll run into them at truck shows and start to talk to them and find out they listen and they don't do any of this stuff. So I think you're on the right track. You said something else that I really liked. You said you were confused. You know, I do a ton of learning. I have for years and years. I read lots of books. I listen to lots of audio programs. I go to seminars every year. And one of the people that I followed for a lot of years, 25 years now, maybe even a little more, is Anthony Robbins. And one of the big things he talks about is that confusion is a great place to be. Because when you are, the reason you're confused is you are on the verge of learning something. If we're never confused, then we're never learning anything at all. When you're in that state, and I know it's uncomfortable. I'm in that state about 80% of my day. I'm confused because I'm this close to learning something. And then you have the breakthrough. You actually learn it and you're not confused anymore. But then if you want to keep improving, you dive right back into something else so that you're confused again.
I agree with you 100%. It is scary. It is scary.
Yeah.
And I mean, just kind of give you a quick background of me. I'm starting to be one of your loyal listeners. I love what you have to say. And I'm coming from the computer industry. Okay, total career change for me, going from a computer engineer to becoming a truck driver. I have my total respect for all truck drivers as of when I made the leap of faith and made the change. At first, I thought, oh, it's the simplest thing in the world. It is not simple.
Right.
There is a lot of variables, and I have the utmost respect for all of the truck drivers that call in, ones that I meet on the road, for you, and for everyone that shares knowledge with someone like myself. I said, I just want to thank you and let you know you're doing, for me, my opinion, you're doing a phenomenal job. And you keep me confused, and I like it because you're making me think. And I've jotted down the 2 books, actually now 4 books, including the ones you spoke about yesterday about the diet. I'm also at the 45 age, so I'm like you, very concerned about my health. I'd like to live as long as I possibly can. And when you're telling me this, and I'm eating grain, wheat-based products, I'm like, oh my God, I got to rethink this process again.
Just wait. I am not kidding. Just wait until you listen to those 2 books. I am serious. The amount of data, and you can't deny it. I mean, there's tons and tons of research out there. There's a million different diets. There's all kinds of people with wacky ideas. There's all kinds of people with good ideas, but it's hard to figure out what's really true. Both of these books, even though there's tons of like real medical data in there, when you start to look at things historically, the way they point out, you look at it and you go, this is true. I mean, this does make sense. I don't care how many other reports might dispute this. There's enough common sense here to just know. And you look at it and you go, I can't believe I spent the first 50 years eating all the wrong stuff.
That's absolutely true.
I know.
Very, very true. Very true.
Yeah. It's kind of scary, but then on the flip side, I'm glad I learned it now rather than never learn it. So what what we like to say around here is welcome to the tribe. Let's go to Las Vegas. Mike, welcome to the program.
Well, I heard you talking about inspections in the beginning, and I got a call because I have one inspection, and I'm confused. I had one inspection, one out of service, and 100% out of service. So I was stopped and had to tighten up a fitment arm nut. And so now I got this out of service on my truck. So it looks damning, although I have spoke to some insurance people, and they say they can recognize some of the circumstances, but they can adjust for that based on the number of years I've been driving, which is about 2.5 years. And they recognize the problem of one inspection, one out of service, and 100%. But that said, I am trying to get this thing down to an appropriate percentage. And I don't know what an appropriate percentage is for out of service. And second of all, if I just go get one more inspection, it'll bring me down 100%. The problem with that is if I go to get an inspection at the inspection station, they might find something else because that's the way they do things. And then I got another inspection out of service. So I'm having trouble wrestling with this. If you could help, if you know, let me know.
I can try. And the reason I say I can try is some things are kind of set in stone. I mean, if we do X, then Y happens. But when it comes to anything that involves a government agency, that never seems to be the case. There's always a lot of other stuff going on. The one area, and I say this all the time, I do a lot of research, I learn a lot, but the one area that I don't stay up on is compliance. And I don't stay up on it for a lot of reasons. It drives me crazy. It bores me to tears. And there are some parts of it that just don't seem to make sense. And one of them is the whole new scoring system. And I don't know that anybody understands it. When I hear the people talking who are supposed to understand it, they don't seem to have any clear answers. There's a lot of controversy, and I have to try to focus in areas where I think I can do the most good. And I just don't think I'm going to add much to the mix if I jump in and try to become, an expert. I don't even like that word, but a so-called expert on compliance. I don't think I would change many people's lives if I did that. It wouldn't be worth the time invested in the little bit of result I would get. So I try to leave compliance to other people who are much better at it than I am. I try to know enough to get by and not be completely ignorant. So one of the things that I try to do is always try to bring things back to what can we do in the real world to make things better. Let's forget about all the goofy rules that nobody seems to understand. What can we do in the real world? The most important thing I think you can do in the real world is to find somebody, whether it's a mechanic, a shop, a mentor, an owner-operator, make sure they really know this stuff. And there are people out there who absolutely do. And you need to get comfortable with the level one inspection process. Now, it's one of the things that we offer at the CMC. We have a former inspector who you've probably heard him on the show many times, Dale Howard. I call him our chief compliance officer. Dale has spent many years on that side of the fence in enforcement. He's also spent a lot of years driving trucks and owning trucks. So he really, really gets both sides of this issue. That's why he's such a valuable asset to us. So I'm going to get to a break. I don't want to rush this. I think it's important, even though I'm not very good at it. I think it's an important issue. So I'm going to come back and we'll talk a little bit more about this. Stick around. I'm Kevin Rothenberg. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're down to the final segment tonight, so I'm going to get right back to the calls. I was talking with Mike in Las Vegas. So, Mike, one of the things that I see most drivers struggle with and owner-operators is they're not very comfortable with the inspection process. It seems like kind of voodoo or, you know, black magic or, you know, the inspectors know everything and we don't kind of thing. When it's like most things, you know, I was just talking about confusion. Once we know it, all that mystery goes away. It's really pretty straightforward, but you have to be taught it the right way and do it enough to be comfortable with knowing that you can look at the truck, look at each individual part, and know whether that part is serviceable or out of service. And it's just a matter of having somebody show you that, and then you seeing, you know, the parts that are serviceable, a part that isn't serviceable, and your pre-trip. And I know, it's not real world that we would do this thorough of a pre-trip every single day, but your pre-trip should virtually be the same as a level one inspection. Those are the things we all should be looking at every day. And if we did, we would eliminate all of those out of service issues or a vast majority of them.
I think when they do a level one, they use a creeper to go into the vehicle and check it out underneath. Now, I keep my truck in good shape. I was a little caught off guard that he found one problem, and it cost a road service and $100 to fix it. And if he would have stayed around, I wouldn't have the 100% out of service. And this is kind of like total unnecessary pain for owner operators to have one nut be loose and get it tightened up in 30 minutes and then have this problem. So anyways, that said, my next problem is I'm going to go to a TA that I've got under good advice, does a complete level one inspection. They're 2 miles away from the weigh station. My concern is that these guys at the inspection stations are liable to create an issue.
Let me address that, because I don't completely disagree with you on any of this stuff. I think it is ridiculous that because of the way the system is weighted, you had one issue and now it looks like you are 100% out of compliance. That's crazy. But the system is what it is. I can't fight against it. It's not going to change. I have to try to work within it. Here's one of the things I can tell you. Two things. I would highly recommend that you at least ask the TA if they'll let you go through that level one with them. And I know sometimes the shops say, no, you can't be in the bay, insurance, all that other stuff. That's why I like shops where you can build the relationship, where they will let you go through it. They'll teach you it. That's ultimately what I would like to see you have do. And when you say, you know, it requires a creeper, you know, maybe it's not a bad idea. In fact, when I'm on the road, coveralls and a creeper, or, you know, I just crawl under the truck. A creeper would be nice, but sometimes I don't carry one with me, and I just crawl under the truck with a flashlight and a, you know, pair of coveralls and crawl around under there and look at everything.
Well, I have a good I do have a good relationship with this TA. It's my local TA, so I buy tires from them and everything else. So I think that will be something that they can do.
Excellent. I would highly recommend you do that. Now, here's the other thing. When you go in, when you drive from the TA down to the scale, request the level one, I can't guarantee you that they're not going to find something that the TA just said was fine. I can't guarantee that. I wish I could, but I can give you some assurance. There is a big, big difference between a truck that rolls across the scale with McDonald's wrappers and Walmart bags and drink cans rolling around on the dash, and the driver looking the other way, hope, don't look at me, don't look at me, don't look at me. They pull that guy around back. They are looking to find something on him, and they know they're going to. They will approach the inspection totally differently, at least the vast majority of inspectors. This is why I can't guarantee it. You never know who you're going to get, but the vast majority of inspectors are going to look very differently at someone when they pull in, request an inspection, and then, you know, even explain that I'm a fairly new driver and I really want to learn this stuff because I'm concerned about being safe on the road just like you are. At that point, everybody's after the same thing. At that point, you two are in agreement. You're both trying to make sure that the truck is safe on the road. You're not the guy who's trying to avoid them and get away with stuff.
I would say that my ace in the hole would be that the TA is only about 2 miles away, and hopefully they won't put me out of service right there. And if I do have any problems, I can call the TA and have them come over and fix it after the inspection that they did on it. So hopefully that'll work. Anyways, I think that's about it.
Again, let's say that there's something that's just questionable on the truck. If you roll through and you're a dirtbag and your truck looks like a dirtbag's truck and you've got an attitude, that questionable item just became an absolute gig. No doubt about it. But if you pull in with the right attitude and you're wanting to learn and, you know, most of your stuff is pretty well squared away, that questionable item now might become a, hey, you know, this is something you should probably take care of, but we're not going to write it up. I mean, you see the difference, right?
Yeah. I got that, and I'm with you on that, and I'm that guy that you're talking about. Not the guy with the junk, just the guy with
right.
No junk.
So, yeah, exactly. So, yeah, it's unfortunate that you had that first experience and that it you know, did create 100%, but you're on the right track. Learn this stuff, get comfortable with it, go get the inspection. Now you're down to 50%, and then we can move on from there. Let's go to Oregon. Irving, welcome to the program.
How you doing, Kevin?
Good.
Hey, I talked to you. Yeah, I talked to you yesterday about my transmission hauling that 104,000 up these Cabbage Hills.
Yeah.
And is there, like, can I put that Pixport power on it to get more power going up these hills?
You are the what I consider to be the ideal operation for a power box. You know, even though I love the power box, in my operation, my trucks running Florida and Georgia, pulling fairly light, I never put a power box on my truck. It wouldn't have made sense. I mean, I didn't need it. It wasn't going to help me with anything. You're at the opposite
right.
end of the scale. You're pulling excessive amounts of weight, up lots of long pulls. The power box is ideal for you because you can turn it up to, say, level 3 or 4 on the long pulls, and you'll get enough power that you won't have to put your foot to the floor, which is, we don't want to be there. We want to we want to be in a gear with enough power that we can be at half or three quarters throttle and get up the hill just fine. And then when we're on the level, we could turn the power box back down to 1 where, you know, we're not producing a lot of horsepower and torque, but we're cleaning up some of the settings and getting better fuel economy. So you are what I consider to be the prime candidate for a power box.
Okay. They're telling me about these diesel freak wire harness. Have you heard about them?
there are tons and tons of products on the market. There are lots of people that are reprogramming ECMs. There are lots of people that make boxes or modules or downloaders or uploaders. There's all kinds of different names, but they're all doing the same thing. They're all changing what the computer is telling the engine to do. Now, I can't address each and every one of them because I can't possibly take the time to try to test each and every one of them. You know, I've explained this a lot in the last couple of weeks, but I think it's worth saying again. When we are talking about mechanical issues, like a different turbo or a different manifold or a different, you know, fuel filter setup, we can see those things. I can see what it is. When we're talking about programming on a computer, we can't see that. I have no idea what they've done in there.
Right.
What I'm really careful of is over the years, I have seen lots and lots of horrible programming. I mean, stuff that will really do damage. I've also seen some stuff that won't do any real damage, but I still don't like their method. The people who don't really understand the ECMs as well as they should, just to give you an example, and I know this doesn't apply to everybody, but in an ISX, the ECM on an ISX is so complicated, there are 6,000 parameters that could be changed. 6,000. That's insane. So the people who don't understand those things in depth will take shortcuts to get better improvement that you see right away. But many times that it's not good. They're changing timing and putting a lot of fuel to the cylinder. That's a quick, easy way to get better performance, but it's got a lot of downsides. There are much better ways of doing it. I've even seen some of these where, in order to get their programming to work right, they have to turn off all the safeguards that are in the ECM. That is an absolute no-no, and they are not telling people that they're doing it. So I don't know whether this one is good or bad. I just can't recommend something that I don't know. All I can say is that before you let anybody change your ECM or use any product, you better understand what it's doing. Thanks for joining me. Be safe, be profitable, do the hard work, and master the journey. I'm Kevin Rothman.
Thanks for tuning in to The Audio Road. If you have any questions, give us a call at 855-800-FUEL. That's 855-800-3835. Check out the website at letstruck.com and find us on facebook.com/letstruck.